you try moral decision-making on any kids yesterday, and if you did, what happened? Two, Wayne wants to throw in a couple more ideas from Piaget. And I will briefly take you through this and show you what it's all about, and then we can get to talking about how you apply some of these things, and we'll go into that also tomorrow, and any problems that arise as we're going along. I was going to kid Wayne this morning. My wife told me not to, so right now I don't know whether I should or not, because I teased him yesterday about... Should I tease him, Phyllis? Okay. I'm about to tease him. They all said? No? Yesterday I kind of casually commented, you know, be on your guard, because Wayne will program you, you know, and I'm supposed to tell you that Wayne does not program anybody. 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 It's not true. Okay, did anybody try out the problem on any children? What happened? By what level and what happened?
A five-year-old girl loaded with should he have stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And she said he should carry his wife into town.
Oh. All right, so she tried to escape the horns of the dilemma by an alternative solution, okay?
Our conversation was very short. Andy is six. I told him the story, and he thought about it, just a little while. He said, I'm mixed up. What did you say, Daddy?
Talk about that one too.
Our 7-year-old immediately, without any thought, said he would break in the window of the truck and take it. And then he added, after that, he said if the lady wouldn't have been hurt, if they would have just been in the ditch with the car, then I don't think he should have taken the truck.
Tried to get the car out and started.
Yeah, but being that she was hurt, there was no thought at all. It just came like that. Because he's on the seat.
Did you ask him why?
Yeah, because she was hurt.
Because she, in other words, that is enough justification.
Yeah.
Person who are hurt need help, whatever is necessary to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anybody else? Alrighty. Tell us a little bit about a couple ideas in Piaget, and then we are focusing on maximizing conversation and minimizing lecturing. We have, every year I threaten to put a little sign up here, and every year it's right about time the last lecture I think of it, but Carol Henderly and I some years ago decided that we ought to have a little sign right up here that only faculty could see, and the sign would say, the oracle is in the audience. And that was a warning to faculty not to talk too much and let the audience talk. So we'll do our best.
There's something about serendipity about this. I was thinking about that this morning as we were going through the Bible study, and then afterwards the presentation on the problem of rich Christians in a poor world. And that is that this is a very good thing, this hood. It was designed, obviously, you know, to pick up the smoke from the fire and so on. But it also keeps the speakers on an eye level. And I was just thinking, what would be the difference between seeing Walt Bowman sitting here and looking at you, and he's already a big guy, you know, and how he would be when he would be at a lecture where he'd be overpowering you and say, what do you think? And if you don't think that, right, I'll get right to you. But there is a goodness about this, about seeing eyeball to eyeball. There is a certain amount of knowledge that is involved in the study of moral development of children, but there are large gaps. I frequently tell my students in general psych, or in any introductory course to psychology, that it's well to be careful that you don't pump up this field more in terms of expectations than it's able to respond. Psychology itself is a very young field in terms of aspiring to be a science, so I think it's especially good for me to be on an eye level right now, because we can deal with experiences, and I can do a little reflecting as to what has been happening, right now, the eye level is very good. Although the strategy basically is for us to give you a little frame in which to deal with these thoughts, and rather than pontificating. So if I ever sound like pontificating, drop off and then I'll stop, and whatever it may be. A number of years ago, I came across one of the fascinating comments that I had seen. We're always grateful for people who take complex things and simplify them enough so that you can still appreciate the complexity of the event, but nevertheless see also that there are basic frameworks to go on. One fellow that I've enjoyed reading quite a bit and use quite a bit is a fellow by the name of Eric Fromm. Now, although Fromm has not said much about moral development of children per se, he did say a marvelous thing, which I would like to use as a kind of an introduction to these remarks. And that is, he talks about people being, conceivably being divided into lovers of life and lovers of the non-alive. And this is what he said. Those who are attracted to non-alive are the people who prefer law and order to living structures, bureaucratic to spontaneous methods, gadgets to living beings, repetition to originality, neatness to exuberance, hoarding to spending. They want to control life because they are afraid of its spontaneity. They would rather kill it than expose themselves to it and merge with the world around them. Now, if there's going to be a generalized theme or a principle that we're going to be dealing with, it is how the child confronts and is confronted with powerful people around him, powerful forces who are saying no to him in many instances and yes to a narrow range of behavior. And because the world is doing this, saying no to him in many areas, you may not do that. No, no, shh, that sort of thing, you know, the shushing mentality. The child pretty well gets to believe that this is a world made up largely of no's or naysayers. The principle that I think is important to remember is this, that for that child to survive in a world of no's, he must say no to it. Now, this is a very tough thing, because those of you who've ever had children and can remember a child saying no, well, won't you want to do this? No. We're going to do this. No! And then maybe even stamping foot and saying no, you know, I don't know what your inclination has been, but you know, you say, go on, let's go. We do it. There was a fellow by the name of Otto Rank who said, when that happens, cherish the moment. And don't only cherish the moment, but find, if you are wise enough to be a wise parent, how to let that child say no, and yet bring him into the reality of conformed behavior. But to say no says, I am a person too. I am a person with enormous impact on me in terms of restrictions and things that I have to do. And as more experienced adults, we know that. We do know that, that this child is going to have to bring his behavior into an allowable range. But if we forget about his right to say no and the necessity of it, and it is a necessity to say no, it may be also one of the heartbreaking things for us that as we go on in life, our children do say no to us in other ways. They may say no to what we believe in spiritually, negatively. They may say no to the church when we say yes to the church. They may say no to our lifestyle and say yes to their own. And at that time, I think every parent experiences, you know, anxiety, saying, well, they're not going to be just like us. Will they be like anything? And that saying of no to us, however, is the fundamental notion of what we're trying to build up to, that surely at the primitive level, punishment, reward, you do as I want you to do, etc., etc. But finally, if we want the child to morally develop, and remember we're talking about development, there has to come a time when he does indeed separate. What did Tim call it last night? Disconnect.
Disconnect.
There is a time when they have to disconnect in this sense of saying, what do I believe in? Because if we live out our lives doing only things that other people believe in who are more powerful than we are of all people the saddest. But this is how Piaget starts it. He said basically, he saw it divided into a dichotomy like that, a two-thing two. He called one of these stages, he said we all go through this heteronomous stage where we think that whatever an adult punishes us for must be wrong. Now just think of that. Whatever an adult punishes us for must be wrong. Is that true of your life space? How many times as a child could you remember being punished for things that an adult said was wrong? And after a while, and maybe even at that moment, you said, I don't think so. I think it was perfectly okay. You know, I don't see what was wrong with that. And maybe even years later, in retrospect, you thought back to it and you said, by George, I was punished on the basis of a matter of opinion rather than on, you know, an objective reality. But to
anger,
right, which is, you know, the best excuse for an adult, isn't it? You know, so, get on with it here. But it's that time, it is at that stage, that from a child's point of view, whatever he's punished for must be wrong. And this is what Piaget basically said was this one major area. He called it the ethic of authority, which is a kind of an interesting thought. He said, the child believes in imminent justice in which the punishment follows invariably upon the violation, and that the size of the punishment tells you the size of the sin. You know, if you're a really klutz, you know it's a big sin. And if you just said, no, well, yes, it's a little, but you know, you kind of gauge, and children are good at this, because they have a lot of rules of the game to follow. What they do is they figure that moral rules are basically external. That's why Piaget called this an objective point of view, or an objective stage. And what moral duty is then is simply obedience to some sort of adult authority. And in our society, many adults still feel the same way. Why, when we obey the rules of society, we are being moral? Is that true? Yeah, to a certain extent. Well then, what are you going to do about civil disobedience in the face of injustice? What are you going to do with Martin Luther King? Those of you who are old enough to remember the 60s, in terms of some objective viewing, might remember, as I remember very well, the furious reaction to some of the civil disobedience that was going on in the 60s. People would say, what right does King have to foment or to incite? What are those nuns and priests doing in that march for protesting? I can remember one time during the Selma march, River Forest was the last word in passivity and quietism, I think. And we, a number of us in the faculty, felt very strongly about the Selma march. Not a majority by any means. And the academic dean says, "Well, if you must, if you feel it, you should march in this thing. Okay, I'll let you cancel your classes." It was a rather authoritarian situation ourselves. I can remember lining up in that long line. We were going to march in the name of Selma, that we believed and affirmed what was happening, and seeing half the student body hanging out of the classroom windows with the instructors, our colleagues, also looking out. And we marched off that campus in a long line, but I can remember standing there feeling a little lonely because we didn't have an awful lot of faculty members standing in line. And one of the most conservative, white-haired, Bill knows him, history prof came up and he just walked right up to us and he stood there and he was ready to march. And I said, "Neelak, I'm glad to see you." And he said, "I'm proud to be here." And we walked off campus, was joined by the Rosary group, came back after that and found ink spattered on the Rosary, on the Rosary wall, said, "No more marching, no more ink." The furious reaction of saying, authority is the thing, is the ultimate judge of moral activity. It was the first time that I had to confront myself personally, I remember that, with this. And Piaget kind of goes on and says, yeah, a child, roughly until about 8, he said, thinks in terms of morality as being externalized. Now, that is not bad, by the way, that there is a God, you know, absolute goodness and all that. We're not touching upon that, but that he thinks it's outside of himself. That's the dangerous part. Piaget said, the time comes when we internalize, when we adopt an autonomous stage, where we say, I believe this, and I will act on it. He says it's much more egalitarian and democratic. He says it comes, and the Herald mentioned something the other day I want to get to. He said that his order was reversed with his own child, and he talked about peer pressure or peer conforming. And Piaget says we do get to know that not from peers, from interaction with peers, that maybe adults are not right all the time. And maybe there is such a thing as doing what I believe is necessary. And that punishment is not an absolute necessity. And by the way, that it is not expiatory. Now that's an interesting thing. Sometimes we say, well, should we punish a child? Doesn't a child feel sometimes great after being punished or saying, all right, don't yak at me, just hit me and then let's forget all this because you're going to just wear out my eardrums and I would rather be doing something else than listen to you harangue me. And so some have said, well, isn't it better just to clip them and say, send them on the way? At a certain stage, it may be. It may be. But remember this, when you buy into that, when you buy into the punishment angle, you are saying, everything is over. All right, now go your way. An advantage? Yes. But also, there is a problem of whether the punishment as punishment has a lasting quality, or whether it's all done. Is there any kind of an internalization of the event for which it was published? We hope that that may be the case. But Piaget said there's a difference. When we move into that autonomous, subjective level, we say, yeah, that was wrong. Or at least I think it was wrong. Well, anyway, it was on this rough categorization, this is a very rough categorization, that Kohlberg began to build his notions. And Bill's going to do that. All I'd want to do is just end up by saying this. I think it would help you to visualize the notion that a child builds his reality in a series of circles. Forgive me for being the teacher on this. But it's his reality to begin with is me. We expend that reality to others, who indeed teach him the reality of the society. But that in itself does not do everything that morality has to do. There is the move beyond that to value, to truth. If in terms of absolute, I don't want to deal with that sort of thing, but to values. Can we get this down? Can we extract what this whole thing is from a me-centered to other-centered to a value that sometimes transcends you and me and how we act to each other? And that sometimes, indeed, we might cause pain to each other, not because we want a pain, but because there is something that we believe in very strongly. That's more complex, and we'll see whether we can get away from that, but this is what it is.
All right, anybody missing this sheet?
As we mentioned yesterday, Kohlberg was a Piaget student, and there are all sorts of resemblances between his six and Piaget's stages. As a matter of fact, the word stages already is a loaded word that suggests that if somebody's talking about stages, unless it's Kierkegaard, who obviously was very much before Piaget, that maybe there's some relationship to Piaget here, because stages is an N-word, just like process is an N-word with John Dewey's educational theory and other theory and so on. These sheets are from, I'm going to check my pages on that so I can give you a reference if somebody's writing notes. Pages 86 to 88 of a book called Moral Education Interdisciplinary Approaches, which is published by Newman Press, New York, New York. And it is major essays and selections of the discussion from a conference that was held a year ago this month in Toronto under Canadian government auspices. And it was an interesting conference in that all of the participants who are in here were asked to prepare an essay in advance. These essays were not read. The essays were sent to everybody who participated in the conference before the conference, and they simply talked back and forth at the conference. And the talk just flowed wherever they wanted to go. And So about two-thirds of the book are the essays, and the other third is highlights set up according to topics of their discussion back and forth as they argued and debated with one another, and it's fascinating. And it's even more fascinating if you know where each one of these guys is coming from, whether he be a philosopher, a psychologist, or an educational theorist. If you know what school of thought he belongs to, you see how he's bringing his school's presuppositions in there and is arguing against another guy's position. So it's a fascinating book. But that's wasting your time to comment about that. If you look at this, very obviously you have three sections: pre-conventional, conventional, and post-conventional, which is a very profound distinction, you know. And each one of these is divided into two stages, so it gives you three stages. If you look at stage one, you discover in rather short order that he is beginning at the point that Wayne was talking about, of beginning heteronymous experience, where the individual's values that ultimately blossom out as moral values are created by adult behavior relative to that child's behavior. When you get to the end of stage six, you have an individual who is functioning autonomously on the basis of very, very broad general rules like the Golden Rule or Kant's categorical imperative or something like this, and is autonomously arriving at decisions about what to do in moral situations. So a person who is almost completely in command of him or herself, morally speaking. And these are the two extremes, and the other ones fall in between. The difference between stage one and stage two is that stage one operates in terms of the child without thinking, equating what later on will be called good and bad, will tend to be thinking or responding in terms of good being, get smiles from mama and daddy, something of that sort, bad meaning I'll get hit, and that kind of an orientation that the child is working with. Now this can get extremely subtle, and it is perfectly possible for an adult human being to be at stage one, because not everybody goes stage 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but people end at a certain level. I suppose it's possible to regress. There hasn't been that much studying going on here yet on the implications of the model, but we talked a bit about that this morning when I was talking with the kitchen staff about some variations going off of it. But all right, the difference between stage 1 and stage 2 is that stage 2 tends to be bring an element of self-relationship into it. And good tends to relate to, will tend to satisfactorily achieve what I want. And bad will tend not to, or it may hurt me too much. I may be able to get what I want, but boy, there's an awful penalty I'll have to pay to get it. So it begins to involve the self in the situation, whereas stage one, it's almost entirely other-directed, and the individual is not asserting his own ego in the situation at all, but is having all of his values determined by other person's response to his behavior. When you get to the conventional level, the difference between stage three and stage four, it kind of parallels stage one and stage two, except that on this level, good and bad are meaningful, at least apart from physical pleasure and pain. And so good tends to be sort of like nice or socially approved of. Everybody in a classroom situation that is at this level know who the best kid in class is. And best in a class approved of sense, not a teacher approved of sense, but a class approved of sense. She's a nice girl. He's a good guy. And it's kind of this level. And what tends to happen as a result of this is there tends to be a kind of behavior aping, and you want to be like that person because that person's nice. And it's not just everybody thinks, everybody in the adult group approves of this person, therefore I want to be like that person because I want to be approved of by adults, but it's more, I approve of that person and everybody else in our peer group approves of that person also, and I want to be like that. When you get to stage four, and I suspect that most human beings in the United States are at stage four and no farther, and that's the law and order. That is a stage where you have a strongly developed moral consciousness. But the content of your moral consciousness is stated in law-like propositions in certain significant forms, like, for instance, the United States Constitution, oftentimes as interpreted by the John Birch Society, or our pastor. He tells us what Christians do and don't do. See, or we learned it in confirmation class, and you got it there in black and white, and there it is. See, so whenever you have a moral situation, you look preferably for a written instruction on what to do. If you're in the armed forces and you're at this level of development, you go by the book. You go by the manual. And you do not go contrary to the manual, because the manual has got it down there. If you're in college and your prof gives you a term paper topic and you're at stage four, you hustle over to the library and see whether anybody ever wrote on that topic before so that you can get the right answers down in your paper. See, so that's this stage. Now, it is it's probably the last vestige of the heteronomous individual, because you are still determining your conduct by a source outside yourself. So notice that it's gone two-thirds of the way in terms of the six of the heteronomous. Stage five then will tend to operate a bit more sophisticated than this, but in terms of operating in terms of, let's say, a cultural context or a traditional sort of way of doing things within your culture, and you figure out ways successfully to do it. It may be sort of like, to use a Wittgenstein model, you know how the game is played in your culture, and you're rather good at applying the rules, and you can be rather original in applying the rules, and you can be creative, but you operate within the game plan. And stage number six is where the individual moves beyond this and functions in terms of principles that are not culturally conditioned or limited to a culture. Tim? That's all I want to say about this, and then we'll entertain questions or comments or things of that sort, and the rest of the period we'll let it wing wherever you want to go on it. Tim?
A question I have on the conventional stage. I've had questions before about concerning the Christian moral development. If one in the conventional period is attuned to a source outside of ourselves.
No. About the best way to jump over into that from a spiritual standpoint is, when you apply the conventional to spiritual matters would be if you take almost anything Kierkegaard has got to say about the ethical stage and the churches reducing Christianity to the ethical level. And it's pretty much the same sort of thing.
Hasn't Colbert himself, though, linked the God relationship to the conventional stage?
Well, it can hit, no. It can hit on any one of the levels. Now, when you're talking, now Kohlberg has not, to my best of my knowledge, Wayne knows more about Kohlberg than I do, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but to best of my knowledge, Kohlberg has not done any writing about six stages as they apply to the spiritual. But you certainly can talk about person at stage one level and how they would see God. and they may very likely see God as giver of good and punisher. And you get different levels of sophistication and different kinds of notions of how it all works.
But even as I try to decide about some moral action in my life that's non-spiritual, that's very material, very empirical, even as I try to do that, and I take my imperative, not necessarily from something that I have within myself, but some imperative that stands outside of me, and I don't even feel, but that is there, the cross and so on. As I do that, am I operating at the conventional stage in that my action is based upon something that I hear and that I feel a commitment to outside of myself, even though at this point I don't have it interiorized? Is that conventional morality?
Yeah, likely. Because if you are operating at the highest spiritual level with the highest degree of autonomy, you are operating, say, from a conscious level, you are operating from a standpoint of a consciousness of God being within you and motivating you, rather than God being outside there, you know, surrounded by thunderbolts and holding up the Ten Commandments. You know, it's the difference between living by the gospel and living by the law. Although I wouldn't want to make that, you know, that perfect an equation, you know, or living by the law being a heteronomous individual, living by the gospel being an autonomous individual, or, you know, you can generate that one out too. But until you are living, you know, as a child of God autonomously, by the grace and the motivation of God, you have not achieved your spiritual moral potential. Phyllis?
Yesterday's three were somewhat similar and kind of fit over these three, and that right. would have been conformity, identification, and internalization. Right. And already yesterday it seemed to blossom in just that way.
That's
that
right.
Conformity would have been the old covenant, the law, the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
And internal, the second, identification is the imitation of Christ, and some people live, you know, and it's not impossible, but it isn't empowering. Whereas the internalization is we are the temple of God and He dwells within us and gives us the strength mm-hmm. to do it.
And it becomes very existential because your uniqueness gets expressed in your unique kind of way. But it is not unethical, but it is beyond the ethical, you know, Kierkegaard would have said. But you reach that level.
Again, it might be useful to think of it maybe in terms of a rippling effect too, that and I think this me, others, there is the truth, is really the rippling effect that I would try to get that in relationship to this. That's why it's a little I think if you can behave, and I hate to use that word, if you can act in a way that is consistent, regardless of who's around you, you are probably moving into the fifth and sixth stage. Now, that is a tough thing, because most of us operate in terms of responses to others. You know, we do all the polite things, we do the conventional, typically,
play.
The role play, the mask, the, you know, the persona or whatever you'd want to call it. We do what we expect people want us to do, but to do what we believe in, we're not called upon to do that most of the time. because, for example, unless you got really upset, what you are doing now is you are acting very conventionally. You are being polite. You're, for example, you're being quiet. You're looking at us more or less, except those of you who are dozing off, and maybe not many of you are doing. But you're doing the conventional thing because you know this is the polite thing. You're not called upon really at this time in any moral confrontation to do what you really think. Like, for example, some of you might really think this is the most boring thing I've ever heard, blah, and maybe even say it out loud. But you don't do it. You wait for the issue to come. Well, okay, let me say, if you would want to make an approximation, and they have done some serious studies on this, in terms of how many adults, Bill mentioned this, and it's a very valid point, you can live on stage one and two as an adult. What do you think is a percentage, using the 100% obviously as everyone, And out of the 100% of adults who make it to adulthood chronologically, how many of you think, what percentage do you think are living on the stage one and two level? Just out of a guess. And I'll just tell you afterwards, as I had to find out myself, I just read it, you know, so it's not divine revelation or anything like that. 75%. Anyone go higher? Anyone go higher than... What's that?
5%,
No, I'm not asking the sixth
level.
I said,
one and
who's
two.
Level one and two? There's one and two on the pre-conventional, three and four on the conventional, five and six on the post.
Their behavior is 90%. Determined either by other people,
90%.
Approval or disapproval of them,
are we ever
or by
getting
some utilitarian point? Achievement.
Someone else. We have 75, 90... Yeah.
Are you talking about the first two levels or the first two stages?
I'm sorry, the first, well, in this case we'll call it the first two stages, right?
First
stage
two
one
stages.
And stage two, which is part of level one.
Okay.
Stage one and stage two, either on the punishment or the reward level.
Adults. Said lower. Yeah, I would have said lower, 25.
25, anyone else?
Oh, I'm more with the 90s.
All right, let's reverse it. Let's ask the other extreme. What percentage of the adult population do you think, from their best estimates, make it to stage five and six?
1%,
anyone?
5%.
2%? Someone else? Carol? 5? Anyone else?
1% or less.
1% or less. The interesting thing is, and we can figure out what goes in between, the middle part, the conventional part, they estimate about 60% of the adults in a civilized society will be at that level. And when you think of it, yeah, it seems that it forbids chaos, doesn't it? We're a reasonably orderly society. About 60% live on that level. Their estimates are that about, and maybe this is high, it seemed high to me too, from just asking the same kind of thing before I even peeked, 10% at the stage 5 and 6 level.
Yeah,
I think it's a pretty high percent. But it's an interesting thing that that 10% up there is congruent with Maslow's 10% who make it to self-actualization in terms of personality.
At
of
least
making
30%
them
then for stage 1 and 2.
Yes, right. But to make it into an integrated stage that I am a put-together person, when we say put-together, that's an integrated personality. I have put the thing together. 10% Maslow said he thought made it to that point. And it seems to be a kind of a parallel percent that seems
it's
to go.
It's interesting that we cut out as many as we did and made it so small because don't you assume that you're in it?
I assume that I go in and out. Oh,
yes, and that's closer to the truth because we do operate on all six levels.
Sure.
Each one of us.
At various times.
But what is it in the crutch? Yes, please.
Doing a lot of brain jumping inside.
That's fine.
Good. Right.
I don't have that paper. If you could send around, it would be helpful. But is this suggesting that it's important to go through the earlier stages before you can go through the sixth stage?
You must.
Kohlberg says you do. You don't plug into life at stage three. You go through all the stages. We had an interesting discussion when I was talking with the kitchen staff in connection with this, kind of Montessori related, and we were speculating because one of the gals brought up one of her pupils that she had in third grade who was very mature and very adultish and who had spent all of his life in the company of adults. And we were wondering whether he had been shortchanged on stage one and two, and that maybe she might not have to try to create some kind of stage one, stage two type experiences he could have to make sure that he had them so that he didn't get messed up later on when he was older. Now, there hasn't been that much study of this sort of thing to get that sophisticated.
Well, the reason I ask is because, I see people, when I work with teenagers, and I see them feeling a lot of one and two, but really wanting to get into the latter,
right.
Five and six.
Well, Kohlberg said that you are, you know, with the exception of stage one, that when you are at a particular stage, you are conscious of and familiar with the stage above the stage you're in. You are aware of the stage below you being inferior to the stage you're at. Now, obviously, you can't do that with one before you start. But that the individual is conversant with the stage at which he is and the stage above where he is. And gradually starts moving into the stage above, in which case then he becomes aware of the stage above that.
I have to say something also in relation to that. You mentioned liberation theology in an earlier experience. Mm-hmm. That there is this notion of liberation, it's not precise. I thought of this in relationship to the notion of liberation. There is a liberation period, which we go through, that's very closely related to this, and that goes back again to Piaget. And that is when the person, when the child gets to the point of being able to abstract his experience sufficiently that it doesn't depend on the concrete anymore, which happens typically around 12, 13 years of age, it liberates him into evaluating systems of values, also again his own. And this is why teenagers are such a pain in the neck, because all of a sudden they come to the realization that they say, the system of values that you've been telling me, I don't agree with. But that is when they have been able to abstract it. And this is where they long for it. You know, they long for this thing of saying, now, there is a great discrepancy between what this world can be and what it is. And the Germans, of course, come up with it, just like the French, with the word that is marvelous. You know, the Weltschmerz of the adolescent. The longing of saying, the unrequited love, for one thing, but also the unrequited ideal compared to the rather cruddy existence. And by George, my parents are part of it.
You know? And it's a rejection of stage four, an attempt to get into stage five, and stage five doesn't work, and they want stage one, but they really don't want it, because they want adult approval, but they don't want it at the same time, and they want to be accepted by adults, and they struggle all over the place, and they zip up and down in stage one through stage five, and right about the time you think you got them at stage five, they're doing stage one type behavior, and you go, ugh.
One of the things I'm particularly thinking about is, in addition to their longing, sometimes we impose that longing on them.
Sure.
In a system sense, let's look at some of our more progressive educational structures and systems, you know, which are primarily operating, I would guess, from five and six. But that the kids have not gotten to that point.
Right.
And because they don't get to that point, or they are not to that point, the progressive educational systems don't work, because they haven't gone through three and four, at least in the complete sense.
Yeah. And not only does it not work, but it hurts the kids.
Yeah, and maybe the kids will regress from that.
Yeah, right.
In other words, you don't teach, what's that thing in the Bible about, you give your cloak to somebody, or turn your cheek. You know, you don't teach that to a kid in first and second stage morality.
Well, if you do, you don't do it in certain kind of ways. And also, you got to kind of watch your educational theories, too, because most educational theories we've discovered are related to particular stages of development. Like, for instance, behavioral mod is terrific for stage one, but it stinks for stage five. And if you try behavior mod on kids in stage five, you may produce some junior criminals, because they know immediately what you're trying to pull, and they con you back, and they see the whole business as one big con game.
Which is an interesting thing, that behavior modification has worked very well with in institutions of juvenile delinquency.
Right.
Because they've never really systematically experienced the systems of reward and punishment.
Yeah,
but when you talk
right.
about turning your cheek, you're not really talking about stages one and two. You're talking about now stages three and four, mm-hmm. where you're interacting with people and finding what are the rules of the game for keeping us a manageable society. And one of them is that you punish also on an interacting level for rules that upset the orderliness of the society. You know, if you do something, if you violate me, I have a right, according to the rules of our society, to violate you.
Yeah. Now, which, when you're talking about, you're even going beyond stage four. Mm-hmm. Because stage four would say, if you hit me, I have a right to hit you back. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And you're asking that child to behave on stage five or stage six level.
Yeah.
On the basis of a principle,
And what you are using as a means of getting the child to act on that high a level of morality is your approval or the fear of your hatred. Mm-hmm. See, and it's not fair to the child.
And then again, don't we have to go back? I mean, from my experience, it's my self-image.
Yeah.
You know, if I don't feel good enough about myself, I can't. Then I have to conform and go along
right.
and please the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I can bring my self-image up and feel good enough about myself.
Right. And a lot of these shifts that take place from stage to stage are brought about by non-moral behaviors. Mentioned to the kids this morning, you may have a child in your class moves from one stage to another stage because they discover how to do multiplication and they couldn't do it before, and it does something for ego strengthening, and all of a sudden they are ready to do certain things in the moral realm that they weren't ready to do before because they have achieved a greater ego strength and a stronger self-image.
I think that's why it's so hard to break through these stages.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, the church tells you one thing, you know, you're
yeah,
boxed
we
in.
Yeah, we've got a lot to learn.
The schools are boxed
right?
in.
We have a lot
could
to learn.
Could I throw in an addition to that? Because I think you're introducing a fundamental thing in this whole business, and that is this notion of self-image. Basically, self-image, forgive this pontificating, and I don't mean to pontificate here, but I thought about this a lot. What is self-image, after all? Or the feeling, the good feeling that you have. It comes about... Basically, I think the best thinking is from two sources. One of them is performance. You get, and I don't mean performance only in terms of obeying the rules of society, but downright competence. I am worth something because I can do something well. I play a piano well. I chop wood well, or what? I build a house well, or I can do things. And that is something we don't want to deny our children, to have them also learn the rules of society to be good and to feel good about it because they perform well. But one that is prior to that in terms of self-concept is that you are worth something regardless of what you do. That you are a precious person regardless of what you do. Now,
this is something you can do in a theological realm.
Well, this is
fantastic,
where, of course, it comes in. It is a very heavy thing theologically,
sure.
Because the affirmation that you don't have to do it. It's already been done for you. But saying that, then you say, now become a competent Christian. Be a good Christian. Not the immoral, but you don't have to do a thing because you are already affirmed before God. If you'd want to move theologically, then it's the right thing to do. But I think psychologically, all I wanted to do was establish a modest psychological point that we have two things that go into self-concept. One, unconditional affirmation, you are okay. And second, you're good at something. And I'm going to help you to be good at something too.
I think that's the process of growth. You're good at something and then you begin to, mm-hmm. to feel good about yourself.
Right.
And then
yeah.
I think it goes beyond that. I mean, in the theological end, that, you know, God made me now beautiful and that I can't love anybody else anymore than I can love myself.
Yeah.
You see, so I think we have to continuously work on this.
We have a practical...
We have a question down here, and then we'll get over
to I'm just dealing with the theory on that. I questioned the second on that, and the second proposition in terms of performance. And I believe, yes, performance is the essential thing, but I can't say, and from my own life experience, that it is what you do well, because well, I think fundamentally goes back to what is culturally accepted as good and whether that thing that you do is valuable within that culture. Okay. I think the question becomes, at least from my perspective, is the question of performance and are you happy with it? Which may not necessarily mean that you do it well.
I'd like to respond to that because I think it's an important point that you can be told it's well done and say, oh, then I know it's well done. But I certainly agree with this notion that you do have mechanisms within you that say, I know it. No one has to tell me. This is good. You know, it's like sometimes in this extreme statement, an artist looking at it and says, no one has to tell me that I've created a beautiful thing. It is beautiful. You don't have to tell a child who's learning how to bounce a ball, oh, you've learned how to bounce a ball.
He knows darn well he is. He has, you know, he's done it. And that's the interesting thing, to watch a child, a small child especially, spending this notion of a limited attention span for children is really nonsense. Children, if they are committed, will spend untold lengths of time on performing, bouncing that ball. Now can I put my leg over it, you know, bouncing that ball. Can I do it again and not bouncing that ball, until, you know, the repetition almost drives an adult wild, but not a child. Competence. And you don't have to have an external force to tell you, nice going, kid, you bounce that ball. I know it.
I was just trying to put some pieces together on a practical level, talking about teenagers, which is a group that I'm not too familiar with, but I'm even wondering with the third grader that someone mentioned at the kitchen group, mm-hmm. And maybe even at third grade level, of a child trying to operate at the 5 and 6 stage level when everyone around him is operating at 1 through 4 level. That would seem to me to take a very strong autonomous individual to, and particularly for teenagers where they're bouncing back and forth.
Yeah, they become okay.
And if
yeah.
they're around people all the time that are only up through stage 4 and never bounce into 5 at all, it's going to be very difficult for them to function at a 5 and 6 level.
And sometimes you have a problem, particularly if they come out of a sophisticated, learned home. They are acting stage 5 and they're really stage 2, something like that. But they're trying to be an adult, and they have been told that that's where they're supposed to be by their parents, and so they play act. You know, it's just like the wealthy husband at the opera. He has to pretend he loves the opera because he's on the board, because he's rich, and so he has to go to opening night and look like he's enjoying it. You know, and his wife goes over to the Art Institute, and she's on their board, and she knows which paintings one is to ooh and ah over and which ones one is not, because she studied it all and she knows how to behave. But it's all phony. And so you always have a problem, or you may have a problem of phoniness. With the little ones, you tend not to, because they're very authentic in their behavior and they tell you what they feel. But when they get older, they can play act. And as a teacher, you may have to do some figuring out at what stage they really are and what will work at that stage and how they can move to the next stage.
And there's also something else I want to respond to when you mentioned the progressive schools. And I've observed at 2 progressive schools, and I found a lot of heteronomy there. So they may have a feeling, you know, and that's a limited observation, granted, but they may have a feeling that they're a progressive school and operating at stage 5 and 6, but in reality they may not be there yet either. So that has to be somewhat cautiously observed.
I must throw this in. Don't mistake operating on 5 and 6 if even the act looks altruistic. Kindness or selfishness, we may say, well, that looks like an altruistic act of 5 and 6, but it may be being done, you know, because the rewards and punishments are coming in the right ratio. To look at the act itself is an extremely dangerous thing.
For sure.
And because you don't know what are the mechanisms. We're talking really here about motivation. No.
And even when you ask them why they did what they did, mm-hmm. You can never prove that they did it for the reason that they said they did. I mean, you take their word for it and so on, and they may have certain conventional, approved of reasons for doing what they did, and they did it for some other reason. I mean, it's a real sticky situation. We will give you a chance for last comment, and then we'll tell you what we want to do tomorrow. And shall we give them another ethical problem? I've got the one about the woman dying of cancer and so on, which we could toss to them.
We could.
Just for kicks, to think about.
That would be okay. I'm just thinking it might be kind of fun just to start out with an agenda of unanswered or unspoken thoughts here. But we'll see.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah.
Well, I was just wondering, when you mentioned you don't know what a person's motivation may be, do we know our own motivations all the time? Can it be that we're thinking, you know, well, I'm doing this because I want to be selfless and love myself, but don't we sometimes harbor thoughts in the back of my mind is, you know, I might get rewarded for this much. Mm-hmm. How can we judge ourselves if we know, you know, how can we know ourselves what level we might be acting at?
It's a kind of a illogical situation. It is not necessary to be able to probe your own motivation to be able to be good at probing other people's motivation. Sometimes we know better than the other person does why they did what they did. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we know better than anybody else why we did what we did, and sometimes we don't. And if we do certain things, I mean, we've learned in abnormal psych and psychiatry that oftentimes when we do things that are very, very shocking to ourselves, we mask the whole business off from ourselves and hide it from ourselves. You know, so those are facts of life. So it's kind of a situation also then that sometimes we are quite sure that we know what the motivation was, and sometimes we're not sure. You know, but it's not like doing mathematics. You don't calculate it out.
This is a good question, though, to continue with, because I think it's got a lot to, you know, that we could do with, deal
okay.
with.
Okay. Let's talk about what we want to get into tomorrow. I want to raise a question tomorrow about when is a person a moral person? Can a person be a moral person and be living at stage one? Are only stage six people moral? Well, if only stage six people are moral, then less than 10% of the people in the world are moral. See, I'm sure you're not going to buy that. But you know, when do we call a person a moral person? What do we want our children to achieve, you know, as concerned parents? What level of competence and so on? And you're going to find it's going to get awfully sticky, but it'll be fun to talk about. So that's one thing I want to get into.
And we'll keep it open. There are so many spin-offs on this thing that the choice is almost infinite. Some things, though, that Larry and Carl have been saying in their earlier notion about nations, trying to talk about the impoverished nations and exploitative nations. I'd like to perhaps deal a little bit with that on a personal level, on a personality level, and see what we can do with that as well. But we're not going to intervene between, that is, impose our agenda upon you without hearing also your agenda.
Okay. Let me get, you want to have another ethical problem we may not talk about tomorrow? We may. I don't have any names for these people. Let's call them John and Mary, okay? And it had nothing to do with the Schrantz. Right. John and Mary. Mary is dying of cancer. John is her husband. They love one another deeply. John discovers that there is a miracle cure for cancer. The local druggist has one dose of it. It costs an awful lot of money, more money than John has. So John steals it and gives it to his wife. The druggist knows that John needs it for it, knew that John needed it for his wife and that he couldn't afford to pay for it. So you got two questions. Should John have stolen it for his wife? Should the druggist have done something to make it possible for John to give it to his wife without stealing it? Okay? Now this is obviously a much more sophisticated kind of ethical problem than the one that we gave you yesterday. But you can try that one out on your friends and see if you can figure out what stage response you're getting of the six stages.